Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're jumping right into something pretty intense: air rescue during the conflict in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and not just the stats, but the actual human stories, the experiences.
Yeah, exactly. Our source material is this really compelling discussion with people who are right there involved in it all. We're kind of zeroing in on some key points they raised, particularly in what you might call their episode 51.
And what hits you immediately is just the sheer scale. I mean, think about it. Over 4,000 people pulled out of the jungle by air.
Wow, 4,000.
Yeah, and you compare that to, say, World War II or Korea, that kind of large-scale air rescue capability, it just didn't exist back then.
Right, so it points to huge leaps in, well, technology, but also maybe a different level of commitment.
Definitely commitment, and the tech followed. A real shift in prioritizing getting personnel back.
And we've got a great perspective on this. The discussion features Daryl Whitcomb. Now, he wasn't a rescue pilot himself. He was a forward air controller, a FAC.
Right. But as he points out, especially in really intense periods like 72, everyone in the air was sort of interconnected with rescue. You couldn't not be aware of it.
So his view from being embedded but not actually flying the rescue helos is really valuable.
Absolutely. It shows rescue wasn't some separate thing over there. It was woven into the whole air operation. The potential need for it or the chance to help out was always present.
Okay, so that's our mission for this deep dive, drawing from that episode 51 source material. Let's try to unpack the challenges, the innovations born out of necessity, and yeah, the human side of air rescue in Southeast Asia through their words.
Sounds good.
All right, maybe we start with the basics. Like, what did they even call it? The terminology wasn't always the same, was it?
No, not at all. It evolved. Initially, the standard term was just SAR, search and rescue.
SAR, okay.
And there's this book by Earl Tilford, Search and Rescue at Southeast Asia, which the guys in the discussion basically called the Bible on the topic, foundational stuff.
But SAR seems a bit general, maybe, given they were often rescuing people under fire.
Exactly. So later on, I think it was in the late 80s, the term CRR emerged, Combat Search and Rescue.
CRSR. Makes sense.
Yeah, it specifically flags those missions where you weren't just searching, you were actively fighting your way in to get someone out. Big difference.
And it didn't stop there, right? There's a broader term used now.
Correct. Today, the umbrella term is personnel recovery, PR.
Personnel recovery.
And that's much wider. It covers everything from the SEER training, survival, evasion, resistance, escape that personnel get beforehand.
Right, the prep work.
To the tech, like survival radios, aircraft tactics, and crucially, the coordination across all the military branches. It's a whole system.
So PR is the big picture, and then within that, different services have their own specific ways of doing it.
Precisely. The Air Force still does CR. Special Forces have something called Unconventional Assisted Recovery, UAR.
UAR, okay.
The Marines call it TRAP, Tactical Recovery of Aircraft and Personnel. And the Army has DART, Downed Aircraft and Aircrew Recovery Teams.
Wow, okay. So each one tailored to their kind of fight.
Exactly. Different names, different tweaks, but all under that personnel recovery umbrella, which really traces its roots back to the hard lessons from Southeast Asia.
And speaking of those lessons, there's a really powerful statistic mentioned in that episode 51 discussion about the impact these early efforts had long term.
Oh, yeah. It's staggering. Yeah. Think about this. At the end of the Vietnam War, the U.S. listed around 2,400 personnel as missing and unaccounted for. That number's down to about 5,070 now, but still huge.
Okay.
Now, compare that to all the conflicts since Desert Storm, Serbia, Afghanistan, Iraq. The current DOD lists only about 10 personnel missing across all those operations. And most of those are civilian contractors.
Only 10 compared to thousands.
Essentially zero military personnel missing from those later major conflicts. It's a dramatic difference.
That's incredible. What do you think drove that? Better tech? Better doctrine?
It's likely a combination. But the point hammered home in the source is that today's personnel recovery success stands directly on the shoulders of what was learned, often the hard way, in Southeast Asia. The sacrifices there built the foundation.
Okay, let's get into the nuts and bolts of a rescue mission back then, using Whitcomb's perspective from that discussion. How did it even kick off?
Well, Whitcomb stresses the absolute first step, the report. Someone had to know an aircraft was down.
How did that happen usually?
Often it came over the guard frequency, 243.0. That was like the universal emergency channel monitored by almost everyone flying.
Okay. Like channel 16 on a boat.
Kind of, yeah. And the HC-130 Kingbirds, these big C-130s kitted out for command and control, were often airborne and played a huge role in picking up those initial calls and relaying them.
So the call goes out. Next step? finding them. Wickham mentioned that wasn't always straightforward, right? Just knowing they were somewhere in Laos wasn't enough.
Not even close. You needed to narrow it down from a general area, like maybe the Mugi Pass, down to specific map coordinates. But even then.
Even then.
Ultimately, Wickham says, you needed eyeballs on the survivor. Visual confirmation. That was the gold standard before you could really commit a helicopter.
And the person on the ground, the survivor, they had things they could do to help.
Oh, absolutely. They were trained, using flash mirrors to signal aircraft, using their survival radios. Those radios could send out a signal that rescue aircraft could home in on using an automatic direction finder, or ADF. And later radios could even transmit actual coordinates. But, you know, the tech kept changing and there was always a learning curve, even in later conflicts, as Wickham notes, constant adaptation.
So location confirmed, visually if possible. Then came support, right? And that was more than just sending the chopper.
Much more. Support started way before with that SEER training we mentioned, knowing what to expect, how to help yourself.
Got it.
Wickham also brings up a modern angle, how quickly families need to be notified and supported now, which is a huge part of the process today. But back then, tactical support meant having other planes overhead.
Like the FACs.
Exactly. Like FACs forward air controllers, which is what Wickham did. They could direct airstrikes to keep the enemy's heads down. Or fighter jets providing cover, protecting the survivor until the recovery asset arrived.
And then the recovery itself. Helicopters, the Jolly Green Giants, were the main tool.
They were the primary recovery asset, yeah. But they weren't miracle workers. Bad weather, really rough terrain, and especially heavy enemy fire could make a helicopter pickup impossible.
But that Bat 21 incident they mentioned.
Yeah, Bat 21, where they lost the helicopter crew, Johnny 67. A terrible reminder of the risks, so they had to get creative.
What other options did they have?
All sorts. In coastal areas, Navy submarines sometimes pick people up, Army ground units, Special Forces teams. They could all be tasked, depending on the situation.
And that episode 51 discussion highlighted some really unconventional stuff, too.
Oh, yeah. Deception was key sometimes. If the enemy expected a big, noisy helicopter rescue.
You sent something else.
Right. They apparently even use things like local farmers with carts sometimes just to blend in and slip someone out quietly. Amazing ingenuity under pressure.
Incredible. Let's talk about who is actually in charge of coordinating all this. The command and control structure, especially around 1972, which Wickham detailed.
Okay. So for the whole theater, the main coordinating hub was the GRCC Ground Rescue Coordination Center down in Saigon.
GRCC. Got it.
The Navy also had its own rescue center coordinating their assets. But operationally, the day-to-day management often happened from forward locations, places like Udorn and Nakhon Phanom or NKP in Thailand and Monkey Mountain near Da Nang in South Vietnam.
So closer to the action.
Exactly. It allowed for faster response. You had this mix of central oversight from Saigon, but decentralized execution closer to where rescues were needed.
And those HC-130 Kingbirds, they did more than just relay calls.
Oh, much more. They often acted as the airborne mission commander. The Kingbird crew would coordinate all the different players involved in a specific rescue, the fighters, the rescue helicopters, the FACs.
So they were like the quarterback in the sky.
That's a good way to put it. Initially, the first guy on scene, maybe the flight lead of a strike package or a FAC, would take temporary command. But that role, on-scene commander, usually got handed off to the Sandy lead.
The Sandy, who were they?
The Sandys flew A-1 Sky Raiders, propeller-driven attack planes, slow but tough. And they carried a lot of ordnance. They escorted the rescue helicopters, suppressed enemy fire, and basically managed the airspace right over the rescue site. Vital role.
Okay. And the source mentioned the 3rd Rescue Group.
Right. That was the main Air Force organization with the dedicated rescue squadrons flying the Jolly Green helicopters and the Kingbird C-130s. They had 4 squadrons supported by the 1st Special Operations Squadron. Those were the Sandys flying the A-1s, plus fighters, gunships, tankers. Whatever was needed, really.
It really sounds like everyone chipped in. A real joint effort.
Totally joint. And even coalition. The U.S. Navy had their HC-7 squadron flying helos off carriers and ships. They called them the Nomads of the Pacific because they were always deployed.
Nomads of the Pacific. I like that.
And Allied forces participated, too. Wickham made a point about the U.S. flag patch on the flight suit that was the unifier. Didn't matter if you were Air Force, Navy, Army, or from an allied nation, that patch signified you were part of the team.
And he also mentioned Army rescue units, but said they weren't officially designated.
Yeah, this is interesting. It wasn't formal doctrine, but Army aviation units flying their Loach observation helos, Huey Slicks for transport, and Cobra gunships for firepower were often the first available asset if an Air Force plane went down in their area of operations.
So they'd just go.
Pretty much. They'd use that same 243.0 guard frequency to talk to the downed pilot. A Loach pilot might act as a sort of ad hoc air boss, coordinating the Hueys and Cobras. They had that presence in their zones, so they could often get there fast. Very effective, even if unofficial.
And then there's Air America in Laos. Their role sounds absolutely critical based on the discussion.
Oh, hugely critical. Air America wasn't military. It was a civilian company contracted by the State Department, basically the CIA's airline. They flew everything in Laos: supplies, personnel, intel missions.
Or rescues.
And rescues. Especially supporting the Laotian forces and the U.S. Raven FACs operating there. The sources emphasized their reliability, their constant presence. If you needed help in Laos, Air America was often the first call, and they came.
A lifeline, really.
Absolutely. And for the really hairy rescues, the ones deep in denied territory, you also had MAC Visage, the military's covert special operations teams, playing a key role.
This brings us squarely to Laos. It wasn't just a sideshow to Vietnam, was it? The source material really stresses its importance.
Not at all. That's a major point. Thinking of the war as just an insurgency in South Vietnam completely misses the bigger picture. Mm. North Vietnam had regional ambitions. They were heavily invested in controlling Laos and Cambodia.
So what was happening in Laos specifically?
You could almost say there were two wars in Laos. In the north, it was about defending the Laotian government, the royal capital Luang Prabang, the administrative capital Vientiane, mainly fighting around the Plaine des Jars.
Okay, the Plaine des Jars.
Right. And then in the south of Laos, the focus was the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the massive logistical network North Vietnam used to supply their forces in the south. The U.S. effort there was all about trying to cut that supply line. Interdiction.
And the Raven FACs we mentioned, they were involved in both.
Deeply involved. Supporting Laotian forces in the north and directing airstrikes against the Ho Chi Minh Trail in the south. That trail interdiction campaign became a massive and ultimately unsuccessful air effort.
Let's dig into that failure to stop the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Why was it so important, and why did the air campaign fail?
Its importance can't be overstated. It was the artery. Without it, North Vietnam couldn't sustain the war in the south at the level they did. Troops, weapons, food, fuel, everything flowed down the trail.
So why couldn't air power stop it? They dropped a lot of bombs on Laos.
An unbelievable amount. But the core problem, as the source highlights, was political constraints preventing large-scale U.S. ground operations inside Laos to physically cut the trail.
They weren't allowed to send troops in force?
Largely, no. Military commanders like General Westmoreland wanted to. Oh. He proposed a major ground operation back in 68 called Operation El Paso to go into Laos, cut the trail, and build a barrier. But it was vetoed politically.
So it was left to air power alone?
Mostly, yes. Mm-hmm. And trying to destroy dirt roads and hidden jungle paths from the air is incredibly difficult. The North Vietnamese were masters of camouflage, dispersal, and rapid repair.
The source had an anecdote about that.
Yeah, Whitcomb mentioned dropping a huge 2,000-pound laser-guided bomb right on a choke point on the trail. And almost immediately, North Vietnamese crews were out there with shovels, filling the crater back in. They were incredibly resilient.
So bombs weren't enough. You needed boots on the ground, engineers, armor.
Things that could physically occupy the ground, block the routes, destroy bridges permanently. But those assets were largely restricted from operating across the border in Laos.
And the source argues this failure was strategically decisive.
Yes, quite strongly. The argument is that the inability to shut down the Ho Chi Minh Trail was a fundamental strategic failure that allowed North Vietnam to keep fighting and ultimately win. Despite the heroic efforts of the Ravens and MAC Visage doing intel and raids in Laos, the main supply line kept flowing.
Even the North Vietnamese histories emphasized the trail's importance.
Absolutely. They call it the Trung Song Road and acknowledge it as their strategic highway to victory. It really reframes the whole conflict when you understand the centrality of Laos and the trail.
Okay, shifting back to the Ravens and rescue specifically in Laos, can you give us a sense of what a typical rescue might look like there?
Well, the source describes a scenario in the Plaine des Jars. An A1 Sky Raider, they call them hobos, sometimes goes down. And what's striking is the immediate presence of different assets. You might have Laotian T-28s already nearby providing some cover, a Raven FAC overhead in his little spotter plane coordinating things, and then, very quickly, an Air America helicopter descending for the pickup.
That speed seems crucial.
Absolutely vital. And there's that great line from a survivor hearing an Air America Huey was coming, just saying, I don't care what color it is, just get me out.
Yeah, it captures the desperation.
It really does. And it highlights that lesson.
Yeah.
Having something available quickly, even if it wasn't the heavily armed Jolly Green, often made the difference between life and death. Using whatever was there, that lesson stuck.
Let's talk a bit more about the Ravens themselves. Sounds like a unique setup.
Very unique. It was technically a covert program. The pilots flew in civilian clothes. Their planes had Lao markings, not U.S. ones. Trying to maintain plausible deniability, I suppose.
Right.
And Whitcomb talks about the experience of flying those slow observation planes, like the O-1 Bird Dog or Cessna L-19, compared to faster jets. Flying low, windows open, really connected to the terrain and, unfortunately, the ground fire.
He mentioned Long Ting Base.
Yeah, Long Ting, a legendary, incredibly busy secret airbase carved into the mountains, the main hub for Raven Ops in Air America in northern Laos.
And there was a strong sense of brotherhood among them.
Definitely. A small, tight group doing incredibly dangerous work, often feeling quite isolated. Whitcomb mentions being part of the last shift of Ravens in his area as the war wound down in 72, 73. He even showed his embassy card, basically, civilian ID replacing his military one.
A strange end to that chapter.
Yeah, a reflection of the complex politics surrounding Laos throughout the war.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, thinking back particularly on the insights from that episode 51 discussion, what are the main things we should take away?
I'd say first, that clear evolution from basic SAR to the sophisticated, integrated personnel recovery system we have today, driven directly by the experiences in Southeast Asia.
Okay, the evolution.
Second, the absolutely critical but often underappreciated role of Laos and the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Understanding that theater is key to understanding the whole war's trajectory.
Right, the Laos connection.
And third, just the sheer dedication and adaptability of the people involved. The official rescue crews, the FACs like Whitcomb, the Army pilots jumping in, the Air America crews. Incredible resourcefulness and courage.
And never forget that number. Over 4,000 lives saved by air rescue. It's astounding.
It really is. A huge point of pride, and rightly so, for everyone involved in those efforts. It speaks volumes about that commitment we mentioned earlier.
So maybe a final thought to leave everyone with. Knowing how vital the Ho Chi Minh Trail was, and knowing the political handcuffs preventing a large ground invasion, what else could have been done? Could technology, or maybe different, more unconventional tactics, have been more effective at disrupting that lifeline?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It forces you to think about the limits of air power and the complexities of that kind of conflict. Definitely something worth exploring further, looking into those less told stories from Southeast Asia.
Indeed. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.